Nothing to fear, but no health care. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With my weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 50 million Americans are without health insurance. 25 million are underinsured. Millions being laid off will soon be added to those rolls. Medical bills cost more than half of personal bankruptcies in the United States. Desperate for care, the under and uninsured flock to emergency rooms, often dealing with problems that could have been prevented. The U.S. auto giants are collapsing in part due to extraordinary health care expenses while they're competing with companies and countries that provide universal health care. Economist Dean Baker calculated how General Motors would fare if its health care costs were the same as costs in Canada.
GM would have had higher profits, making no other changes, higher profits that would equal $22 billion over the course of the last decade. They wouldn't have to be running the government for help.
General Motors is sometimes referred to as a health care company that makes cars. Former Chrysler chair Lee Iacocca said in 2005, it's well-known fact that the U.S. automobile industry spends more per car on health care than on steel. He supports national health care. Barack Obama said in a 2007 speech,
affordable, universal health care for every single American must not be a question of whether, it must be a question of how. We have the ideas, we have the resources. Now we have to find the will to pass a plan by the end of the next president's term. Now I know there's cynicism about whether this can happen. And there's good reason for cynicism. Every 4 years, health care plans are offered up in campaigns with great fanfare and promise. I'm sure that this campaign season will be no exception. People evaluate them for a day, and then they move on to find out who made the latest blooper or gaffe on the campaign trail, and by the time a president is sworn in, the interest groups and the partisans have torn down whatever ideas have been offered, and we're back to business as usual. The plans collapse under the weight of Washington politics.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in his March 1933 inaugural address, famously declared,
"The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance. We face our common difficulties. They concern, thank God, only material things. The withered leaves of industrial enterprise lie on every side. Farmers find no market for their produce. And the savings of many years in thousands of families are gone. More important, a host of unemployed citizens face the grim problem of existence, and an equally great number toil with little return. Only a foolish optimist can deny the dark realities of the moment. And yet we are stricken by no plague of locusts. Compared with the perils which our forefathers conquered, we have still much to be thankful for. Nature still offers her bounty, and human efforts have multiplied it. Plenty is at our doorstep. Practices of the unscrupulous money changers stand indicted in the court of public opinion, rejected by the hearts and minds of men. Yes, the money changers have fled from their high seats in the temple of our civilization. We may now restore that temple to the ancient truth. This nation is asking for action, and action now.
This was Franklin Delano Roosevelt in his March 1933 inaugural address. Deep in the Great Depression, a flurry of ambitious policies followed, detailed by New York Times editorial writer Adam Cohen in his new book, Nothing to Fear. He writes that FDR developed the New Deal with key visionary advisors and cabinet members who enacted bold policies, among them Frances Perkins, the United States' first woman cabinet member. Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, pushed for a rapid national relief program that formed the basis of the welfare system and for regulations on the minimum wage and maximum hours and a ban on child labor. But Perkins failed to achieve universal health care. This is Adam Cohen.
She really was the conscience of the New Deal in many ways. And yes, she chaired the Social Security Committee, and she wanted it to go further. She actually wanted it to include national health insurance. But the AMA, even back then, was very strong and opposed it. And she and a couple other progressives on the committee said, you know, we better just settle for what we can get. They didn't want to lose the whole Social Security program.
Barack Obama nominated former Senator Tom Daschle, a Secretary of Health and Human Services and director of the new White House Office of Health Reform. Daschle's health care book, Critical, recalls historical failures to achieve universal care. He writes, like Clinton, Truman had reason to be confident. His fellow Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, and polls showed that Americans were anxious about the high cost of health care and eager for change. But both presidents underestimated the strength of the forces arrayed against them, special interest lobbyists led by doctors in Truman's time and insurance companies in Clinton's, writes Daschle. Obama knows the issue well. While his mother lay dying of cancer, she still had to battle the insurance industry. Again, this is Barack Obama in that 2007 speech.
Plans that tinker and halfway measures now belong to yesterday. We can't afford another disappointing charade in 2008 and 2009 and 2010. The federal government has to lead. Another more controversial area when we look at the healthcare crisis is how much of our healthcare spending is going towards record-breaking profits earned by the drug and healthcare industry.
Yet Daschle proposes not much more than tinkering, improving Medicare, Medicaid, and the Veterans Health Administration, all examples of single-payer healthcare, in which the government is the single payer for the healthcare, while preserving the inefficient multi-payer for-profit insurance model. In December 2007, the American College of Physicians compared U.S. healthcare with other countries, writing, single-payer systems generally have the advantage of being more equitable, with lower administrative costs than systems using private health insurance, lower per capita health care expenditures, high levels of consumer and patient satisfaction. Michael Moore, in his film Sicko, includes a recording of John Ehrlichman speaking to Richard Nixon discussing medical insurance profits. He's recorded saying the less care they give in patients, the more money they, the insurance companies, make. Obama's in charge now. Whom will he emulate, Nixon or FDR? People across the political and economic spectrum, from big business to the little guy, are dying to know. I'm Amy Goodman, with help from Dennis Moynihan.